This recording of the Sunstone Symposium Series is brought to you by Signature Books. This is Steph Larson here to discuss one of our newest releases, Island Adventures, The Hawaiian Mission of Francis A. Hammond, 1851-1865, by John J. Hammond. Observant listeners will notice that the subject of the book, Francis Hammond, and the author, John Hammond, share the same last name. That's not a coincidence. You're noticing some expert-level genealogy. John wrote Island Adventures after researching his great-great-grandfather Francis and studying his diaries. Francis Hammond was an LDS missionary to Hawaii, then known as the Sandwich Islands, but his life was not always one of church service. Hammond was a convert to the church who spent most of his young adulthood working as a whaler, and he had lived in Hawaii prior to his conversion. As a missionary, this gave him a unique set of skills. He's adventurous, accustomed to dealing with physical hardship, and already familiar with Polynesian culture and people. But this also made him a little bit of an outsider in Mormon circles. He'd only been a member for 2 years when he was called on a mission, and he never quite settles into orthodoxy, even though he tries. For example, he agrees to take a second polygamist wife, but after both women die in childbirth, he refuses to participate in polygamy again. He and his third wife remain monogamous despite pressure from within the church to maintain the principle of polygamy. One of my favorite aspects of Island Adventures is how it shows the way Mormonism has evolved and become increasingly more mainstream over the years. Author John Hammond points out that 19th century Mormonism, with its belief in polygamy, the doctrine of blood atonement, the imminence of an apocalyptic millennium, speaking in tongues, faith healing, frequent rebaptisms for health purposes, and a host of other characteristics, is far removed indeed from the mainstream 21st century LDS church members' expectations. Yet there are aspects of the early church, especially the branches in the Hawaiian missions, that are still deeply familiar. Modern Mormons will recognize the church's struggle to negotiate contemporary issues like gender, race, and power within its membership. For example, Mormon missionaries and settlers are both horrified and fascinated with the Hawaiian culture, especially its approach to human sexuality. John Hammond describes the cultural gulf between the Hawaiians and the missionaries as enormous, stating that Mormons were contemptuous of the easy Polynesian lifestyle. The sexual norms and practices of the natives included both polygamy and polyandry. There was public nakedness and lewd dancing, that's their description of the hula, incest, abortion, and homosexuality. Basically, all the stuff Mormons still fret about: women in their clothing, suggestive music and dancing, female bodily autonomy, and non-patriarchal, non-heteronormative relationships. Remember, Mormons are okay with polygamy under the directives of church leadership, but polyandry and homosexuality are still deal breakers. So while many aspects of Francis Hammond's Mormonism will seem unfamiliar, debates about tobacco use, multiple baptisms for a single person, members being taken by the Spirit and speaking in tongues, there's still a strong connection between Mormons navigating an unfamiliar Hawaiian culture and contemporary Mormons trying to navigate an increasingly non-traditional and unorthodox global society. Another thing that makes Island Adventures unique is the inclusion of a female voice and perspective. The diaries of Francis Hammond's first wife, Mary Jane, are prominently featured in the narrative, allowing us to see the colonial mission experience through a different lens. Mary Jane and Francis occasionally clash in their views on religion, most notably when an outbreak of smallpox threatens the lives of many people living on the islands. Hammond and other Mormon leaders have decided that the smallpox epidemic is a test of faith, advising both members and missionaries against receiving the smallpox vaccine since they believe God will spare his righteous followers. Mary Jane disagrees and vaccinates her children against her husband's wishes, causing Hammond to grumble and complain that Mary Jane was preventing him from, quote, ruling his own house in righteousness. You've got to admire Mary Jane in that moment, going against church leadership and her own spouse in her desire to protect her children. I'll end with a review from Professor Gina Colvin, author of the book Decolonizing Mormonism. John J. Hammond has produced a delightfully candid account of his ancestor Frank Hammond's mission to Hawaii. Family histories are too often triumphant and congratulatory. Hammond's story is anything but, as he casts a critical eye over both the religious and cultural colonization of a people and the ethnocentrism that allowed for it. Brutally honest in recounting the fraught nature of these 19th century cross-cultural encounters, Hammond's work is informed and fresh. Island Adventures is available on Amazon in both print and Kindle editions and in local bookstores.
listening to the Sunstone Podcast by the Sunstone Education Foundation, bringing you quality discussions surrounding Mormonism from the recorded audio from our past summer symposiums. Sunstone brings you over 40 years of engaging, thoughtful discussions around Mormonism. Check us out on iTunes under Sunstone Magazine, visit our website at sunstone.org, and join us for our many conferences and events.
All right, so welcome to our session. This is the session on exit, voice, and loyalty, rethinking dissent within the LDS community. And we have a number of wonderful speakers here who are going to give voice to some wonderful comments, I hope, which will not make you really want to exit. So I'm going to grab my packet so that I have all of our bios in front of me.
We're loyal.
This person on my left is John DeLynn. This person is Jack Jeffries. She is a student on the history of Christianity in America at the Trinity Evangelical Divinity Seminary, right? And she has her degree from Brigham Young University, blogs extensively on Mormon evangelical interfaith issues and dialogue at the very popular and well-known Clobber blog, as well as LDS Talk. John DeLynn is an active member of the LDS Church and the founder or co-founder of several Mormon-themed blogs. He goes through about one a month. He podcasts mostly at Mormon Stories, but also writes at Mormon Matters, Stay LDS, Mormons for Marriage. He's worked 15 years in the high-tech industry, including 7 years at Microsoft. He is a former director or board member of Sunstone, and is pursuing a PhD in clinical psychology and counseling at Utah State. Christine Hagland is the editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, and is also a well-known blog presence. She's colloquially known as the founder of feminist blogging, or feminist Mormon blogging.
Erupted in applause.
And I'm Amy Wenger, and I blog at a couple of sites, especially timesandseasons.org, and I'm an assistant professor of law at Thomas Jefferson Law School in San Diego. Woo! He's the best of the founders to have a law school named after. So a couple of introductory notes. Things to remember. We do have a microphone there where hopefully when you get some good comments and Q&A, once the panelists have spoken, when this is happening, speak into the microphone so that your remarks can be recorded for posterity and for the strengthening of the members committee. The session is being recorded. If you do have a comment or question, please keep it to a reasonable time length. You're all wonderful people and have all good comments and questions, but we would like the panel to be able to address them. So please think through your comment and state it cogently. And thank you for coming so far. And on that note, I will start with my talk. So let me grab that one 1 second. All right, so as we know, the LDS Church has a lengthy history with institutional responses to dissent, and much of this history is not particularly friendly. And in fact, there are a variety of strong messages about dissent that have been reiterated. Speaking about symposia, a few decades ago, Elder Dallin H. Oaks said, the church is directed to avoid disputation. In some instances, the overall presentation of symposia may be inaccurate or unfair because of the position of the church is not presented, and thus resulting in something destructive, which a faithful Latter-day Saint would not wish to support or promote. Which seems, okay, if that's the only statement, but there's a variety of other statements. Elder Boyd K. Packer writes, I've been disappointed when I've read statements that belittle or degrade the church or past leaders of the church by those who are supposed to be worthy members of the church. We are to avoid purchasing writings from known apostates. We should realize that when we purchase their writings or subscribe to their periodicals, that we sustain their cause. We hope that their writings would not be on your bookshelves. Remember, here's a great quote, when you see the bitter apostate, you do not only see the absence of light, you see the presence of darkness. Do not spread disease germs. Now, these statements are not limited to simply apostasy, as so characterized, but in fact are made sometimes in the context of broader criticisms, and so we get Elder M. Russell Ballard writing, there are false prophets and teachers who have or claim to be membership in the church. Let us beware of false prophets and teachers, both men and women, who are self-appointed declarers of the doctrine of the church. He continues, like Korihor and Nehor, they rely on sophistry. Who are these people? They're people who challenge the first vision as authentic experience. They declare the Book of Mormon and other canonical works are not ancient records of scripture. They try to redefine the Godhead. And he famously concludes, in the Lord's church, there's no such thing as loyal opposition. One is either for the kingdom of God, or one stands opposed. So this is a model of discourse with which we are familiar. There are a number of people in the room who are personally familiar with this model of discourse. It is something which has affected the arc of Mormon studies, and it greatly affects the lived experiences of Latter-day Saints as well. So some of our presenters are going to be discussing some aspects of this. This has great potential to cause pain. And for those who have attended sessions about September 6, about excommunication, about ways that the community expels members who are engaged in discourse which is not viewed as proper, there's a great deal of pain that is evident in the lives of people who have been affected by this. Is this the only way to approach dissent? I'd like to suggest that it's not. And in fact, drawing on some work from political economist Albert Hirschman, I'm going to suggest that there are other important considerations as we frame the question. So Hirschman writes a book 40 years ago now. His book is Exit Voice and Loyalty. And it's not about churches, it's about organizations. So it's about businesses, it's about political entities, it's about organizations in general. You're dissatisfied with Coke, and so you switch to Pepsi. You're dissatisfied with the Democratic Party, you join the Republican Party. You're dissatisfied with this workplace, you find another one. People have a variety of responses to dissatisfaction with an organization. Hirschman's key insight was that criticism of an organization's practices is actually one of a variety of these responses, and his analysis suggests that in some circumstances it can be an evidence of greater loyalty to the organization itself. So he breaks out two broad concepts called exit and voice. That is, when someone is dissatisfied with an organization, be it their workplace, their church, their political party, they've got a couple of options. One is to, as it's often said, to vote with their feet, to leave the organization, to say, I'm out of here. And this will have a variety of effects. If enough people are exiting, the organization will realize we are doing something wrong, and this will have a sort of a feedback effect, and the organization can hopefully fix the problem. Of course, some members of the organization will have exited in that process, but if the organization is trying to respond to this sort of feedback about member discontent, it will read this exit and say, we have a problem, and will respond to it. So exit in a lot of ways is clean. It's an economic solution. So it's impersonal. You don't tell anybody, I'm leaving, and you can sort of storm out and slam the door behind you, which is perhaps a mix of exit and voice, and we'll discuss that in a moment. But mostly exit is clean and impersonal because you just leave. You just say, I'm not getting what I need here, I'm going elsewhere, and the organization has to sort of read between the lines and realize we're forcing people to exit here. Exit is quiet. The organization eventually does become aware of the exit or suffers the consequences. Not as many people are buying Coca-Cola, we need to change our packaging. Not as many people are coming to this organization, we need to change the way we're marketing or structuring it. The other major option is voice. And voice, in contrast to exit, is very messy. Voice is talking to people within the organization, either through institutional channels or through informal channels, and saying, here is something that is bugging me right now about this organization. Voice requires articulation. It gives the institution direct feedback instead of indirect feedback. And as Hirschman notes, both exit and voice can be very effective tools for facilitating or instigating institutional change. Both of them, he suggests, are most effective where we have a mix of what he calls inert and alert members. And so the alert members realize, I have a problem, and they either start exiting or they start advocating through voice their concerns. One way or the other, the organization gets the clue and responds. But in the meantime, there's another mass of members of the organization who aren't as alert and who are just, through inertia or whatever other reason, not paying attention. And they keep the organization rolling during this transitional process. And finally, Hirschman suggests there are some potential limits on some of these mechanisms. In particular, exit may be blunted by the entry of new members. If the organization doesn't realize that people are exiting because other people are entering, this would obviously limit the effect of exit. Not all organizations are susceptible to exit. To use an economic term, exit works best where we have substitute goods available, where you can switch from Coke to Pepsi with a limited amount of, hopefully just a limited amount of cognitive dissonance there. And whereas if it's a non-substitutable good, it's much harder to engage in exit. So given that framework, in the few minutes that I have left, let me talk about exit and voice in the LDS community. Exit is a distinctly limited option in the LDS community for a couple of reasons. The first is that to the extent that someone accepts LDS doctrine, exit seems to be an untenable option because we're taught that LDS ordinances are a non-substitutable good. We get the statement, whither shall we go, Lord? Thou hast the words of eternal life. There is no particularly good place to go on exit, and therefore members are to a large extent stuck. Members may be stuck as well through cultural limitations. They may be living in the Mormon corridor. They may otherwise be in a family situation where they feel like exit is not a viable option for them. As Hirschman notes, obviously, where exit is not the only option, or where exit is not an option, voice may be the only way to express dissatisfaction and to give the organization itself valuable feedback, saying your members are dissatisfied and this is a potential concern. And crucially, as Hirschman concedes it, voice is not intended to undermine the organization, to destroy the organization, to harm the organization. Voice is a type of way of expressing dissatisfaction, but it's ultimately a type of constructive feedback to hopefully help remedy a lapse in the organization itself. So I think applying Hirschman, we could suggest that the traditional perception of no loyal opposition is not correct, or perhaps not nuanced enough, and instead it is loyalty to the organization, a desire to see the organization respond to its problems, which prompts voice. If people really don't care, they just check out. And so the people who care are the ones who speak up. These are the people who are not disloyal, but are in fact exceptionally loyal. They share their concerns because they care. And by advocating change, they're investing in the organization rather than taking the easier route of escape. This suggests a few ways to rethink LDS views on dissent. One thing which I think we should avoid is one popular apologist reaction to dissent, which is, fine, go away. And we see this articulated most prominently in Hugh Nibley's discussion of the Chess and the Checkers Club, where we are an organization who plays chess, and if you want to play checkers, you should find somebody else to play checkers with, because we are doing things our way here, and this is what we do here, and if you don't like it, please exit, which is a way to really silence voice. There's some real downsides to this. I think if we were to apply this in church culture, we might say, here we are a patriarchy club, and if you want to be an egalitarianism club, go join the other club. But here we have people who are happy to be the patriarchy club. What do we do to respond? Many people do leave. Many people get the message from apologists, from church leaders, from others, that their voice is not welcome and that they should exit, particularly women, particularly members of the gay and lesbian community, particularly younger people are receiving the message that their voice is not welcome and that they might as well exit. I'd like to suggest that it would be better, healthier for the organization to encourage and foster dialogue, not just in the magazine, not just
but
in the
periodicals. But if they wanted to, that would be great.
Absolutely. And in both senses, to foster dialogue and to allow voice to flourish and bloom in the LDS community. Would we rather have someone be expelled from the community, no longer part of us, treated like they're full of disease germs? Or do we want to see them, sort of their energy and passion for investing in the organization turned into constructive feedback and turned into something that we can admire as part of our community? We should respect and recapture the value of voice. I'm encouraged by some things that I've seen. I attended Laura Compton's panel about correlation. Well, there was somebody there who said, these are some ideas that I'm going to suggest to church correlation committees. I think that's exactly the right response. And I think that as we recapture voice, we can recapture some of the energy of our community and do so in a way that respects the voices of all of our members without unduly encouraging exit. Thank you.
Hi, you guys. I'm guessing that there's a lot of people from the blog and Apple here who know me and have probably gotten into arguments with me. but most people know that I'm not LDS. We mentioned that in my bio. I'm not LDS. I'm an evangelical Protestant. And sometimes when I get into these discussions with Latter-day Saints online, talking about maybe they're critiquing something about the church that they're not happy with, maybe they're doing something else, questioning something that a leader did, and I'll sometimes pile on and join in the critiquing and the questioning and kind of egg it on, however you want to put it. But there's often people who have turned to me and said, you know, we're not supposed to speak against our leaders, or they've expressed a sentiment to that effect. And I always say, I'm Protestant. Our entire religious tradition got started when one guy, one church member, took a list of complaints and nailed it to someone else's door in a public area. I mean, he didn't privately try to reconcile it with his bishop first. He went and he made his voice heard. And he didn't really intend, something that some people don't know about Martin Luther is that he didn't really intend to start his own religious tradition. He honestly wanted to reform the Catholic Church. So I think it's kind of the intersect of two different worldviews when I get into these conversations, because one of the things about, well, being my kind of evangelical at least, I am what I call an evangelical mutt. It means that I've been members of a lot of different denominations and congregations. I've been Nazarene, Presbyterian Church USA, Assembly of God, New Frontiers, and now I am currently a member of the Evangelical Covenant Church. I hope to stay, but that's because they are a denomination that doesn't really take position on a lot of things. They let you believe what you want, so they're a good home for somebody who's an evangelical mutt. So I basically joined a denomination of evangelical mutts. But the point of that is that I come from a lot of different, I've embraced a lot of different things across the Protestant spectrum. I see a lot of good in different Protestant traditions. And I guess I'm a convert to denominationalism, which is something that I think is very misunderstood in the Latter-day Saint movement. I mean, one of the very first things that my LDS friends told me as I began studying the church is, how can Protestantism be true? You guys have all these squabbling, bickering little sects. And I was kind of confused. I never really thought about these things when I first began studying the LDS church. But at the time, I was like a deer in the headlights when people brought this accusation up. I had no idea how to respond to it. But as I've studied and I've gotten older, I've struggled with my own faith and studied my own religious tradition, what I've learned is that I really like denominationalism. One of the things that I like about it is that I have the ability to question and to doubt and to critique my leaders as needed. It all kind of reminds me of that part in Star Trek where Captain Kirk, they're trying to take away his pain, and he's like, I need my pain. I need my bickering denomination. So that's how I feel about it. But, guess we'll bring all this up because I'm trying to explain. The Bible says, as iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. I just quoted a gender-neutral translation for you there. But it's a good thing for people to be able to, you know, here, let me let you know a little secret here. One of my best friends online is actually Aaron Shapovalov from Mormonism Research Ministry. And every time he shows up on the Blogger and Apple, people seem to hate him and get into fights with him. And I get into fights with him, too, all the time. But we have very, very different perspectives on how to approach Mormonism. I jokingly called him my nemesis today. But the thing is that we bounce our ideas off of each other, though. And maybe his ideas get a little softer and mine get a little harder. But we critique each other's systems. He's a Calvinist, complementarian. You know, he's a fan of the countercult ministry. And I'm an egalitarian, Arminian, and I'm sleeping with a Mormon. So this is my husband in the front row, by the way. Anyway, so we have very different approaches. But we critique each other, and we feed off of each other. And that's the kind of relationship that I love to have within Protestantism. And I like seeing it on a larger level. I like being able to critique John Piper and other evangelical leaders that I don't agree with and get my voice out. The thing about evangelicalism, I'm not just trying to plug for evangelicalism, by the way, I have a point, but about evangelicalism is that there's room for dissent. There's room when I don't agree with what my leaders do. There's room to go somewhere else. I'm going to quote a friend of mine. His name's David Clark, and he used to blog for Faith Promoting Rumor, but he himself is kind of in the process of joining a Protestant church now. But this was a quote that he posted to a message board. I don't have his permission to share this, by the way, but he posted it in public, so it's fair game. He said, "I think that the evangelical world is much better equipped to handle this phenomenon of people entering biblical studies in academia, is what they're talking about, than is the Mormon world. And if the Mormon world wants to make a contribution to biblical studies, it has to find ways of providing safe harbors for serious biblical scholars. There have been improvements in this area recently, but in my opinion, not enough has been done. And because of the way the LDS Church is structured and the types of truth claims it makes, I'm not sure that the LDS Church is structurally capable of providing safe harbors for these scholars. As an example, take two worst-case scenarios of scholars who ran afoul of the truth claims of religious schools, David P. Wright and Peter Enns. Both got canned by their employers for heresy of sorts. David P. Wright got excommunicated by the LDS Church and ended up becoming a non-believer. Pete Enns got a new job and is still a card-carrying evangelical. And that's the structural problem LDS scholars face. If your scholarly work upsets the powers that be in the LDS Church, there is no place to go religiously. An evangelical who pisses off one group of evangelicals just gets a job with a different group of evangelicals." That was what my friend David said. I was struck by something that Kaini said. Am I pronouncing your name right now? George. Okay, I was struck by something that George said as he was giving his talk. He quoted, were you quoting Dallin Oaks when he said, "There is no loyal opposition in this church"? And I guess what I thought is, how many people here agree with that? Agree that there can be no loyal opposition in your religious movement? And if you don't agree with that, I guess you kind of just have to take the steps and start being loyally oppositional. Now, I know that Mormons do not want a denominationalist system. Okay, I know I'm not going to sell you guys on denominationalism, but I think that there just has to be, one, I think that people should pursue trying to set up a separate academic institution for Mormons from BYU. I know there's a, what is it, Southern Virginia? One that your sister went to?
Yeah.
Is that, I don't know if they tolerate academic dissent better, but I think that Mormons need to pursue having other academic institutions. I'm sorry, what are people whispering?
No.
SVU is worse.
It's not more tolerant.
It's not more tolerant. Okay, I don't know. I know that Claremont's got their Mormon studies program. I imagine that there's more academic freedom there. But I think that Mormons just have to pursue having Mormon studies programs in other universities and setting up other universities where people can have academic assent without fear of losing their job, at least. But there's still that whole fear of losing your membership to deal with. But I don't know what advice I can offer Latter-day Saints for how to make the church more tolerant of dissent, other than to start throwing yourselves against the electric fence until it weakens. And sorry. I remember hearing, I think we just discussed asked this a little bit in our last session, though, that I spoke at. Would the September 6th phenomenon happen today? And a lot of people do believe that the church has become a little bit more tolerant of intellectuals and scholars. And looks like Richard Bushman's Rough Stone Rolling. And I remember talking with a friend who said that, like, 20 years ago, Richard Bushman probably would have been in trouble for writing Rough Stone Rolling. It would have been seen as an antagonistic book, but he was able to carefully discuss some troublesome issues with Joseph Smith's history. It's now seen as an extremely faith-promoting work. So I think that things are getting looser, but I know that internal critique has to be done, though. I mean, that is how a denomination... You know, one of my favorite people in Mormon studies is Blake Osler. Now I'm terrified of Blake. Hold on. I'm terrified of Blake, because I'm not a philosophy person, and Blake will come into my discussions on different blogs and just, like, pwn me at philosophy. But I like him because I think that he pushes Mormon theology in new directions, and he's just not afraid to question how things are laid out and to try and reinterpret the theological framework that Mormonism has set out. And I think that Mormonism needs 100 scholars like him. I think that that's good for the church to explore its own theology and for people to engage in that kind of theological self-reflection, exploration. I was reading a book not too long ago called Mormonism and Dialogue with Contemporary Christian Theologies, where I was reading the chapter on feminism, of course, and Rosemary Radford Ruthers was responding to Camille Williams, and what she said was, there was this part where Ruthers was supposed to respond, and she said that she refused to critique Mormonism because she believes that theological critique is a job for believers. And I think that she was right, and maybe I need to back off and stop critiquing you guys so much, but I think the best theological critique comes from within, and that it has to be explored, and that you just have to keep trying until the church gets a little bit more tolerant of faith and sin. And I admire you guys a lot. I don't envy you, but I admire what you guys try to do, though. I love the blogger network. I've talked to you about that, I love the blogger network. I remember talking to a friend of mine, I think it was Seth Rogers from Nine Moons. I was talking to him, and I said, I wish that the blogger network had been around back when I was first investigating the church, because I had so many questions and issues with the church, and there was just nowhere I could go, really, and have my questions heard and have people say, it is okay to have these issues. You know, I was in touch with a lot of LDS apologists, and they kind of just acted like it was stupid for me to have these issues. But I really wish the blogger knuckle had been around in 1998 when I first began studying the church, because it would have given me room to explore and to discuss and to question these issues and not feel like I was wrong for doing that, and not feel like I was defective for doing that. So I admire you guys so much. I would encourage you to keep at it, and keep on throwing yourself against that electric fence and, until it gives, and just try to make space for internal faithful dissent. Thank you.
I really appreciate Kaimi's invitation to be part of this panel, and I really enjoyed what Kaimi and Bridget have had to say so far. I was asked to kind of contribute to the panel more from an anecdotal perspective. Because of the podcast that I've been running for the past few years, I've had this unique experience of having people contact me at the rate of something like 2 to 3 a week with stories and experiences that are troubling, where they feel like I'm somehow going to be able to help them. And so I've probably counseled over 1,000 people over the past 5 years, either through visits to Logan for lunch, or my business travels where I'll meet with people, or emails or phone calls. And so I guess I draw on those experiences to inform a few of my comments. But I want to begin by saying that I personally have had some extremely constructive opportunities to express my voice within the church. I had a very difficult mission experience, much like the baseball baptism scandals in the early 1960s in Great Britain, where in Guatemala the missionaries were engaging in really egregious behavior as it related to baptism. And when I got home from my mission, I was enraged, and I even tried to talk to a mid-level general authority, and when that mid-level general authority took that to the top, he came back and said that the church just had decided that it wouldn't be worth the benefit to do anything with the mission president at the time, and so they decided to kind of let the thing go. And that was very troubling for me at the time. It kept fostering within me for several years until I got some professors from BYU to write a letter with me, or to edit a letter that I wrote and gave to Elder Oaks. It was hand-delivered by a professor friend of mine. And one surprising day in Washington, D.C., while I was on Washington seminar, I received a phone call from a woman that said, church headquarters, could you hold for Elder Oaks, please? And for the next 15 minutes, I got to have a conversation with Elder Oaks. And he made sure I was feeling okay. He asked how I was doing. He apologized for my mission experience. He expressed regret. And he told me that he took my letter that I wrote him, made copies of it, gave it to every member of the Quorum of the Twelve and the First Presidency and the Church Missionary Committee. And then he followed up a few months later with a talk that he wrote specifically addressing the issues that I had addressed to him in my letter, for the talk that he gave to mission presidents, newly outgoing mission presidents and their wives, as they were going to go out and serve missions. And it was all around not addressing missionary work like a sales force, and, you know, not using sales incentives to drive missionary success, and not being so based on quotas and numbers. Even a couple years later, on a business trip, I happened to see Elder Oaks in first class on an airplane with his wife. I dropped him a little letter to thank him for that letter he sent to me, and he sent me a beautiful letter back telling me he remembered my letter to him, and he thanked me for it, and he felt like it had really helped the church make some progress in that area. So I would be ungrateful if I didn't acknowledge that. I will also say that over the past year, I've been given the privilege of having lunch twice with another member of the Quorum of the Twelve, thanks to a connection that I have. And I had the opportunity to voice some concerns with that person, and had a really rewarding and uplifting experience in some ways, and was grateful that I'd had that opportunity to voice some of my concerns on behalf of the people, I guess I don't want to say constituents, but the people that I saw and work with. So having said all that, I guess all I have is a bunch of questions based on what I've heard so far. I had the good fortune of interviewing Carolyn Pearson a couple weeks ago for my podcast. It was a wonderful experience, and we spent about an hour on women's issues, and she talked about the time that she was doing the play Mother Woe of the Morning in the late 80s, how she was basically traveling all around the world giving this play about Mother in Heaven and how important Mother in Heaven was. And I was thinking about my limited knowledge of Mormon history and how that same type of discussion led to, while I was at BYU, Cecilia Farr and Gail Houston sort of being dismissed, and then how many of the September 6th were women who were talking about Mother in Heaven and prayer to Mother in Heaven and things like that. And I wondered, how did Carolyn Pearson get off kind of scot-free, and then so many other people were punished? And I've had many people come to me and say, John, I can't believe you interviewed Grant Palmer and you interviewed Paul Toscano and Margaret Toscano and others. How come you haven't been excommunicated? And, and sometimes it makes me think, well, maybe I, you know, better stop what I'm doing and be careful. But I have thought about it a little bit. And I guess I've come to one conclusion, or a couple conclusions, that I submit here for discussion. I do think that there are two things that you can do that can help guarantee or dramatically increase your chances of being punished for something you write or say or the voice you express. One is if you openly criticize the brethren. If you openly criticize and denounce and repudiate the brethren and their authority, I think you open yourself up to being punished. And I don't know that Carolyn Pearson ever did that, and I've tried really hard with Mormon Stories not to do that. As I listened to maybe Paul's Sunstone presentation in the late 80s, it felt to me like he kind of was doing that. And I wonder whether that was one thing. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't criticize the brethren. I'm just saying that that seems to be one thing that leads to that end. The second is openly denying the truth claims of the church. So in that case, you think of someone like Grant Palmer. He didn't just say, I have some questions or I'm struggling with some things. He basically wrote a book that gave the indication that he felt like the church was a fraud, but a good one, and one that is still laudable, and one that we should, you know, the Book of Mormon might be, you know, built on lies. At least it moves us closer to Christ, and that's okay. I think that's going to guarantee that you're probably going to get punishment. But if you can figure out a way to express your voice in a way that doesn't do one of those two things, maybe you aren't as vulnerable as I think other people have been able to demonstrate. I do want to add a third thing. I guess that the church makes a very careful calculation as to whether or not the PR risk or cost of punishing someone outweighs any potential benefit to the general membership. And I can think of a couple of examples of that. When Thomas Murphy came out with his writings on DNA in the Book of Mormon, he was summoned for a state court. But then the press got involved, the press was alerted, they came to his aid, and conveniently the court was called off. And to my understanding, he's never been called back since. So I think having Peggy Fletcher Stack or Jennifer Doudna as a friend can be very helpful in protecting you, frankly. I can also think of Buckley Jepson as another example, as a gay man who was in a Washington, D.C. ward. His bishop was going after him for being an openly gay man with a partner in church trying to serve.
Husband.
Sorry, what did I say?
He said partner.
Pardon. Husband, yes. For just trying to be in the ward, but in a way that wasn't traditional. A bishop started harassing him. The media found out. This got into the press. And mysteriously, his bishop was called on a mission. and the subsequent bishop left him alone, and he was never punished. So I think it's wise to consider ways, if you want to express voice, to have the protection of PR behind you. I would like to say that it was a little hard to read what little of this book that I actually did read, as it talked about decisions of which cola to drink, and to compare that to the experience of disaffected members of the church or people who are struggling. And I know Kaimi didn't mean to infer that it's that simple, and he ended up saying that it isn't. But, you know, I've had a few gut-wrenching experiences. One is a very, very dear, close friend of mine who lost his faith, but then became an apologist, and then lost his faith again, but then tried to become a Fowler Stage 5 Mormon, and then finally lost his faith again and hasn't really recovered it. And at some point, both his wife and his mother delivered the news to him that if he didn't step up, they would both be united in taking the children and the wife away from him, and he'd be losing his family. And it broke my heart when I read that this beautifully talented, sensitive man, who is a well-respected professional by trade, was riding his bike down the street one day and was starting to feel the intense desire to drive his bicycle onto oncoming vehicles. This is a lot more serious than a cola decision, and it's really messing with people's lives in a very serious way. And you know, another example is a man, very similar situation, who's about to lose the woman that he truly loved, and she loved him. And the only issue between them was he couldn't believe in the church anymore. And she had been raised in a home without a father who was a believer, and she just didn't want to be in a home without a husband raising the kids who was a believer. And I remember the desperation that this man left with me on a phone call, and we ended the conversation, and he said, you know, I can't believe that I'm losing the woman that I love to a cult. And he hung up the phone. And I'm not saying the church is a cult. I love the church, and I'm an active member of it. But from his perspective, a cult was taking the woman that he loved away. And their marriage was, by both's account, because I had met with both of them, their marriage was perfect in every other way, except for the fact that he couldn't believe. So exit is difficult. Sometimes, thank you. When I had this opportunity to spend 3 hours with a member of the Quorum of the Twelve, I first turned down the offer because I couldn't imagine a question that I could ask him that would be of any worth. What was I going to ask? Like, you know, when did Joseph first receive the polygamy revelation? Or like, was Fanny Alger legitimate? Or, you know, help me understand the DNA thing a little better. Like, I honestly, I didn't want to put him on the spot. I didn't make him nervous. I had no idea how much he knew or didn't know. But the last thing I wanted to do was have it be awkward and embarrass him or myself. Eventually, I agreed to have the lunches, and I thought of some questions to ask him, and it was a pleasant conversation. But I've often asked myself, what recommendation could I make, could Sunstone make to the church that would actually be helpful from the brethren's perspective? And I have asked this question to lots of people. And I think that you have to sort of, any recommendation you have to give has to sort of meet a couple criteria. It has to not weaken the church. And when I say weaken the church, I mean lead to a decrease in membership and a decrease to members' commitment in terms of the time they're willing to dedicate to the church and the money they're willing to dedicate to the church. Because to ask the brethren to make any decision that would lead to a decrease in tithing or a decrease in membership activity is probably an unrealistic request, as idealistic as we would want to be. And so I think I have a hard time coming up with suggestions that would lead to an increase in activity rates and membership. You know, I used to think, well, let's get them to apologize for the blacks. Well, is that really going to make things better? I don't know. So I think that's one of the questions that I have is what's a recommendation we could make that would actually improve the church based on their values? And so I'll just end by saying that as I think about some of the secrets to voice, one is I think that I don't think the answer is to speak to the brethren. I think the brethren pay attention to the membership and how they're feeling often. And so if you penetrate the consciousness of the general membership, then you get the attention of the brethren. And so I think that's an effective way. I think that, so that's number one, is forget about trying to give advice and steady the ark. Change the hearts and minds of the people and see if that flows upward. I think it often will. Second, I think that art is a beautiful way to deliver your voice. And I hope that we can see a re-flourishing of art. When I was talking to Carolyn Pearson, she sold 150,000 poetry books that were based on Mormon theology to Mormons. Can you imagine 150,000 poetry books being sold today? My Turn on Earth and Saturday's Warrior, some of you may love them and some of you may hate them. But like, there was a time when theater and musicals and books were really encouraged within our culture. And I'd love to see a day where that can re-flourish. And maybe it's happening and I'm just missing it. But I hope that we'll look at more ways for art and radio shows and popular magazines and TV shows and books and theater and movies to try and inspire the masses. And then finally, I think that everything we do needs to sort of be done under the idea of making sure that you have the protection of the church's concerns about public relations on your side, so that there's nothing you can do that would put yourself vulnerable and give the church a good excuse to come after you. And that's something to think about. There was a day when I worried that in the Eugene England, Bruce R. McConkie battle that was waging, that Bruce R. McConkie would win. Now I've realized that that wasn't the battle at all, because today the risk is that both Bruce R. McConkie and Eugene England will be completely forgotten and that no one will remember either. And so I hope that we can find a way to reinvigorate minds and hearts so that this type of dialogue can continue. So those are my comments. Thank you.
It was hard in preparing this, thinking about this, not to just keep... not to just keep thinking of titles of French existentialist drama. it's a hard topic, and it's not happy. I want to start with Hirschman, and Kaimi kind of sketched out his general argument. I want to push on just one point. There's a section in there where he starts developing his theory of loyalty, which he says transfers the sort of economic and political model he's been using to organizations like families and churches where there are higher barriers to exit. I think it still doesn't work for Mormonism, and here's why. Here's what he says. Loyalty is a key concept in the battle between exit and voice, not only because, as a result of it, members may be locked into their organizations a little longer, and thus use the voice option with greater determination and resourcefulness than would otherwise be the case. It is helpful also because it implies the possibility of disloyalty, that is, exit. Just as it would be impossible to be good in a world without evil, so it makes no sense to speak of being loyal to a firm, a party, or an organization with an unbreakable monopoly. While loyalty postpones exit, its very existence is predicated on the possibility of exit. Even the most loyal member can exit is often an important part of his bargaining vis-a-vis the organization. The chances for voice to function effectively as a recuperation mechanism are appreciably strengthened if voice is backed up by the threat of exit, whether it is made openly or whether the possibility of exit is merely well understood to be an element in the situation by all concerned. And that passage grabbed me because, of course, he's taking very Mormon ideas and coming to a conclusion that is completely inapplicable to the Mormon Church. I think what he says is simply untrue with respect to Mormonism. At least in the internal logic of Mormonism, the Church has an unbreakable monopoly. There are a few moments where exit may matter for new converts, for post-mission men, for young people who are exiting in large cohorts. It may matter. Otherwise, it doesn't. I don't mean to say that it doesn't matter to individual church members or church leaders. Every person's exit from the church affects someone else, usually many others. And I think leaders care deeply and may even think more deeply about certain issues when they are broached by members with concerns serious enough to leave the church over them. But statistically, for the institution, unless you belong to a large, identifiable cohort of exiters, it just doesn't have anything like the kind of leverage that Hirschman describes. It might, in the context Bridget describes, where interdenominational movement is possible, but I don't think it works in institutions with the kinds of truth claims and robust notions of authority that, say, Catholics or Mormons have. This is not to say that there are not honest and compelling reasons to exit, only that exit is not a productive mode of articulating criticism. So that said, we have to talk about voice and criticism from within the institution. Matt Bowman, whose paper I was tempted to just read outright because it's very smart, and it's in dialect to which you should all subscribe. Borrowing from a Catholic theologian, Avery Cardinal Dulles has formulated the problem this way. At the same time, Dulles reminds us that dissent always occurs within the context of a church, not merely as a rejection of it. This is important because for both Catholics and Mormons, belonging to a church means membership in an ecclesiastical body that claims to be more than merely a gathering of Christians. Rather, God is in contact with the church as well as with the individual. In other words, the church is a sacrament. It is a channel through which God extends grace and duty to human beings in ways not possible for individuals alone. In such a religion, authority and conscience exist in dialectic. They can condition each other, strain at each other, but neither can exist fully before God without the other. The church does not exist for its own sake, but neither do we gain salvation in isolation. So one can and should dissent as a member of a faith. The act of dissent should not be understood as a departure from that church, but rather as an act within it that draws upon its theology, history, and relation. A Mormon dissenter should dissent first as a Mormon. I would assert, contra Hirschman then, that dissenting as a Mormon requires abandoning the possibility of exit and making it plain that one has done so. In his Ten Commandments for Alternate Voices, Armin Moss has offered some suggestions for how to do this, and you probably all know them, so I'm not going to read them also because there's no time. John Jerome Peters articulated a similar point in an interview with Ethan Jorgensen, also in Dialogue of Subscribe, locating in the person of the Apostle Paul a model for would-be critics. Jorgensen says, yeah, as long as you're bringing up Paul, how would you present this to Mormon audiences? Paul's idea that, as for myself, I'm not necessarily bound by the law, but for others who feel bound by the law, I respect their view and their field of vision. This is a very different Paul than most Mormons would feel comfortable, I guess. And Peters responds, this is actually a deeply Mormon Paul, one who combines deep devotion with respect for reason and care for the other. He is believing, modern, and neighborly all at once. It seems to me that Paul's argument is that if you have higher knowledge, you should prove it by your higher kindness, rather than by exposing or insulting or belittling people. So I think Paul kind of gives a mission for the intellectual, the task of understanding those who are not intellectuals. He talks about those who have gnosis, the Gnostics. What are they supposed to do? They are supposed to respect the narrower field of vision of the other. Ethan, yours, and then asks, does that mean you accept what the other has and don't try to stretch them? And Peter says, well, why should I ask them to stretch themselves if they are not asking me to stretch myself? I may have knowledge, but what's it worth if I don't have love? The best way to stretch your mind yourself sometimes is to stretch your mind into a smaller box. He says, now I call it condescension into the idea that it is a smaller box. Maybe it's just a different box. I don't know. If it's not a mutual enterprise, why should it be just a one-way thing? We all know that the best teachers are those who are vulnerable, those who are ignorant, who really want to know. And I would reformulate this for critics to say the best critic is the one who is sincerely trying to understand and sustain the church leader or policy she is criticizing. We have a distinctly Mormon articulation of this possibility in the Doctrine and Covenants. You'll recognize this, I'm sure. No power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, only by persuasion, by long-suffering, by gentleness and meekness, and by love unfeigned, by kindness and by pure knowledge, which shall greatly enlarge the soul without hypocrisy and without guile, reproving betimes with sharpness, and then showing forth afterwards an increase of love towards him whom thou hast reproved, lest he esteem thee to be his enemy, that he may know that thy faithfulness is stronger than the cords of death. We cite this verse always, directed at those who wield authority by virtue of priesthood office. And yet, if we take seriously the idea that personal revelation and faithfulness also confer the authority of knowledge and wisdom, these words must surely apply to us as critics as well. We cannot prevail by force of argument, by threat of exit, or insistence on credentials or superior knowledge. We claim the power of our own revelation and wisdom only on the same principles that priesthood authorities claim theirs. We may, indeed, we must regard ourselves as fellow citizens with those who are temporarily, that's important, in authority over us, and our discussion must recognize that we are engaged in the same project, even if that project is so large and beyond all of us that the visions we see through a glass darkly appear to be in conflict. I want to insist that calling for a critique articulated in community and in love is not to suggest self-censorship. Faith lies in acting according to the commandments of God and being dedicated to the work of building the kingdom, not in twisting one's reasoning faculties into a knot to believe that manifestations of human weakness in the church organization are somehow finally sanctioned, which is to say, friends don't let friends perpetuate racist, sexist, homophobic, or stupid policies. A fearful silence is the very opposite of speaking the truth in love. And I want to insist on that. It's the opposite of speaking the truth in love. To finish up, I want to offer a complicated and troubling example of one such critic named Levi Savage. And I have stolen this succinct sketch of his biography from Nate Ullman at Times and Seasons. He says, Savage was a Mormon's Mormon. He emigrated to Nauvoo after joining the church, where he was intimate with Joseph Smith. After the saints left Nauvoo, he traveled west with Brigham. In 1846, at the urging of church leaders, he signed up for the Mormon Battalion, marching hundreds of miles through the desert until his discharge in California in the summer of 1847. From there, he made his way across the Sierra Nevadas to the Salt Lake Valley, joining the saints in October, only to find that his mother had died crossing the plains that summer. In 1852, he was called on a mission to Siam, now Thailand. He left his wife and 21-month-old son walking from Salt Lake to San Francisco, where he caught a boat to the Far East. During his passage, he almost died of smallpox. He spent over 2 years preaching the gospel in Asia. He landed initially in Calcutta, but couldn't make it to Thailand, Siam, due to a civil war in that country. He did, however, get as far as Rangoon in Burma. In October 1855, he headed for home, reaching Boston, Massachusetts via the Cape of Good Hope in early 1856. In short, Levi Savage was a man willing to make enormous sacrifices and literally circled the globe at the direction of the leaders of the church. From Boston, Savage made his way west to winter quarters, where he had joined the Mormon Battalion more than a decade earlier. There he met a group of Western-bound immigrants from England. At the urging of a prophet and apostle, Franklin D. Richards, this group of immigrants formed themselves into two companies, one led by James G. Willey and the other by Edward Martin. The companies were part of an experimental system of moving immigrants across the plains with handcarts. The initial attempts with the new handcarts had gone well, and Richard assured the immigrants that if they trusted in the Lord and did their duty to him, they could cross the plains in safety. By this time, it was mid-August, and Levi Savage, who knew something about the problems of crossing the vast distances of the North American interior, was incredulous. He insisted, forcefully, that it was too late in the season to begin. The handcarts might be trapped in the high Rockies by an early winter. It was too dangerous, he insisted. His objections were overruled by his ecclesiastical superiors, to which he responded, "What I have said I know to be true, but seeing you are to go forward, I will go with you. I will help all I can, I will work with you, I will rest with you, and if necessary, I will die with you. May God in his mercy bless and preserve us." I think, alas, that this may be the only viable model of dissent, the only expression of voice that can matter in the church. And cheesy though it may be, I think it finally comes down to love, the sort of loyalty that motivates us not just to articulate criticism kindly, in ways that consider the needs and capabilities of those to whom we are speaking, but to be willing to die with the saints because we love them beyond all differences of opinion, and indeed beyond all reason. In a community that aims not just at acceptance, but at the transformation and redemption of its members, criticism must proceed from the unshakable love and commitment and the sort of radical submission of the will that Christianity demands. In some ways, especially immediate practical ones, this is profoundly unsatisfying. Do not deny it. Savage's counsel, after all, went unheeded. Robust authority triumphed over knowledge and wisdom and probably personal revelation. We can multiply examples, indeed, that is what we have been doing these last few days, of silly policies and worse, of lives wrecked by uninformed or uninspired counsel from authorities. I know something about this. From my own life, lest you think I speak lightly. This is the tragic price of the freedom that is ultimately redemptive, the gift of a God who demands that we work out our salvation with fear and trembling, both individually and collectively. Our love of God and our love of each other are ultimately meaningless without the opposing possibility that we will disappoint and fail and hurt each other, sometimes terribly. But if the scriptures are to be believed or at least taken seriously, we have to grapple with the model of criticism that proceeds by submission, that insists that the meek will inherit the earth, and that the bonds of love are stronger than death.
Thank you, and we'll start with our first comment from Jan.
I have one comment about voice and one comment about exit. My comment about voice is that sometimes it's really helpful to have other people do your dirty work for you. And I've experienced this personally where a few years back, my then state president had promulgated a policy in our state that women were not allowed to say the opening prayer in a sacrament meeting. And I thought this was bogus, and I said so and vented aloud to a number of my friends on a number of occasions. When we got a new state president, a friend to whom I had vented was then my Ward Relief Society president and wrote a letter to the new state president talking about a conversation with me, leaving me completely anonymous, heartfelt letter saying, you are hurting people with this policy. I hope you will think seriously about changing it. And the policy was changed. So that's my comment about voice. And it's always helpful to have. And this goes to what John was saying about if you can infiltrate the masses and build it from there, that you can affect change. My comment about exit is that part of the problem is that the way the church has defined those who leave.
Right.
And this is seen in the gospel doctrine lesson from church history about the pint of Crete. And that it's that the only reason people leave is because they are sinning or they are offended. And so this has come in my own life where my husband has stopped attending church. And while I have tried to avoid situations in which I am forced to explain his absence, in the couple of conversations I have had, I've had to reiterate repeatedly, he's not angry, he's not bitter, he's not offended, it wasn't something somebody said, it wasn't, you know, an overnight decision. People leave for other reasons. People may leave just because the church is not making them happy. It's not working for them. But Mormons who are active and fully subscribe to everything that they are taught at church can't fit that into their mindset. They have no way of understanding and appreciating that.
narrower field of vision.
Yeah. Do we want him to address Dana's comment? Let's take Dana's comment, and then we'll address both. Or yes.
Well, I really enjoyed the panel. I appreciate the comments. It provokes lots of questions, but since I have to pick one, I want to push the panel, and I guess in particular, Kanye and Christine, on the underlying premise, right, which is Hirschman's framework of exit voice and loyalty assumes that you're functioning in what Foucault would call situations of normal discipline. Here's your French existentialism. Right? And Foucault being Foucault is much more interested in situations of crisis discipline, where the organization says, we have an emergency, the organization is at risk, we don't have time for due process or dissent or voice or those kinds of things. We got to do with all that and have martial law or military tribunals or extraordinary rendition, all that kind of stuff. And Foucault says there are two situations where an organization does that. Right? One is situations of plague, disease, and the other is situations of war. And of course, leadership sometimes will invoke those images, even if you don't have an actual disease or an actual war, in order to seize the situation of crisis discipline. So I'm very struck by Kaimi's quotations about spreading germs, right, and disease, right, the rhetoric of plague if you interview the Toscanos or other people, right? And I think we can find plenty of rhetoric about war, beginning with the war in heaven, being extended to our mortality and so on, in the statements of church leadership. So the sense I get is that we're not even at a point where we can talk about exit voice and loyalty, because leadership believes, or would like us to believe, that we are in a situation of crisis discipline. Now, if I'm wrong about that, I'd love to hear it. And if I'm right about that, I'm curious to hear what the panel thinks about how we sort of modulate ourselves away from the rhetoric of crisis to a situation where we can actually implement some of the suggestions that you're talking about in terms of exit and voice and loyalty.
Some great comments. I don't know which of the microphones are working, so I'll just...
They're all on? Oh. They're all on, and none of them work very well.
Thank you. Oh, yeah. So, hello? Hello?
Yeah.
Excellent. Great. I'm going to put this way in the back there. Yeah,
it's not better without the mic.
Okay. Well, I've been...
But it has to be recorded.
It's for the recording.
Yeah, it's for the recording.
So, great comments and really interesting reactions. I mean, the idea first that we might not even be in an exit voice loyalty construct is, I think, provocative. And one of my friends, when I was a Mormon feminist, I was telling her my paper, and she said, "What about silencing?" and her view was that Mormon women don't get voice or exit; they are forced into silence. I think that's a problem. It's a huge problem. And I think that's absolutely right that the organization does what it can to discourage both voice and exit by saying, we will, shoot the dissenters, or in this case, damn the dissenters, in a very serious way. I'm interested, and maybe we'll ask Jack about sort of why such a crisis model has not been the case for evangelical groups, but I think and I hope that to leverage a little bit on what Jane Ann suggests, I mean, this goes to both the pint of cream and look at those folks, they're evil and they're bad and stay away from them, but at the same time it goes to her other comment, which is that sometimes by sort of articulating a concern and getting into the zeitgeist and getting people talking about it and generating buzz about it, perhaps that we can reach our people and I like to think that they have some amount of good intention. And if we can generate sort of positive buzz, probably, following John's comments and Christine's about, what type of buzz works, that maybe we can alter the crisis mentality, because I think the crisis mentality is a big, big problem.
I'll just add really quickly, I don't doubt that maybe some of the church leaders are thinking in a disease or a war crisis mentality. But I also think there's a heavy dose of pragmatism in the way that they approach the church. And I think that they know best what actions and behaviors are likely to result in a tapering of decline or a chance of growth in terms of activity rates and other things. And so I think there's probably a pragmatic trade-off of, are we willing to marginalize these minorities and lose them for what we feel is the benefit of the greater body of membership. If we placate these vocal minorities, do we risk broader defection among the masses? And I think it's probably for them a very utilitarian decision.
Dissent is best articulated, as we, somebody said, within the faith.
Eat it. Speak loud.
What's your mouth?
So
project.
It was expressed that dissent is best, most effective within the faith. But I feel like a forum like this, Sunstone, is definitely outside of the structures of the church. And it certainly makes a lot of us very brave to talk about the church here in these very intelligent ways. But I'm not sure if I missed this because I stepped out. But what are we doing as a group here to talk about strategies for engaging the church and creating a space for dissenting Mormons and refusing to play into this in or out psychology of active and inactive? And like we're kind of sitting here, dissenting within the church. I've had very positive experiences expressing what I thought to be controversial ideas, but I've been very pleased with the result. One example is I'm from California, and during Prop 8, testimony meeting, a litany of folks was bearing testimony in Prop 8, and I got up and announced it and said my loyalty was first to the Sermon on the Mount, with the area authority sitting there presiding over the meeting, who was actually the state president at the time when I went on my mission, so we were close. And after the meeting, 50 people came to me with tears in their eyes, thankful that they had a friend or a brother or anyone, or a son who was struggling as a faith Mormon within Prop 8. So it is my testimony that speaking out, that dissenting within Mormonism can have much more positive results, especially if it's in the language of humility. And so I would just put that out there, that let's talk about strategies. How do we engage Mormonism and create a space within it? Thanks.
You're probably going to say the same thing as I am, just one word, blog.
Blog.
Actually, I was going to say, just from a procedural perspective, I think we've got 8 people in line right now, so let's get 3 comments in a row, and then we will try to address them in a cluster, and that should move things a little more quickly.
Okay, question drive-through.
Drive-by.
I thought that what everybody said was beautiful and important in a different way. Christine, I loved what you said, Christine, right? I loved what you said. It actually made me cry. But at the same time, I do want to say, I come to Sunstone and I hear a lot of good advice about not being angry, being forgiving, practicing Sermon on the Mount principles when dealing with people we disagree with. I think that works really well. I think it's really important. And coming from the family I can, I don't know how not to do it almost, even if I wish I did sometimes. But I also want to make a case for resistance. And I think that sometimes if we focus on forgiveness and kindness without recognizing a power structure, that we're allowing a power structure to continue in a way that is so harmful to so many people whose voices don't count. And I think we spend a lot of our time figuring out how to make powerful, frequently white, frequently male people feel comfortable at the expense of how to make people who never have a voice count. And sometimes I think that takes resistance, standing up, and sometimes I think it requires saying something that hurts some people's feelings at the top. And I think that's really important. I don't often talk about this, but my grandpa was a general authority, and I recently watched the Prop 8 movie, and I found out how involved he was with stopping gay marriage in Hawaii, and it broke my heart. And my brother's gay, and that he's not alive anymore, but I love my grandpa, and I wanted to go to him with my brother and say, like, look at this person. He never gets to speak. Like, who is going to speak for him? So I think what you said includes that, but I just really want to make a case for resistance and dignity and sometimes standing against power when it compromises our dignity or would allow pain to happen on a broad level. So.
I'm supposed to follow that. Listening to what you said, Christine, I was struck by what you closed with and saying that if you're coming from a place of love, it's just much more effective. But I would say, was that not what you were saying, Christine?
Sometimes it's effective, and a lot of times it isn't.
Well, I think it's more right for the person saying it. Even if the person hearing it doesn't. But conversations that we were having earlier about effectiveness, I was just thinking a lot about, it's not that it's not, I have articulation powers that are absent from me now. Okay, I'm going to regroup this. When I'm trying to convince someone of something who believes widely different than me, I do find that even people who are deeply dogmatic will back down off of that if you're not talking to them about a specific policy or you're not talking to them about trying to, you know, reverse their beliefs about something specific. But if you say, like the conversations that I've had where someone, you know, talks about apostates and how they leave in sin or anger or, you know, any other thing that they do, if I say, I'm not Margaret Toscano, and I have to tell you, she's got deep love for the church. They don't have a response for that, or if they do, it's a very different one. And then you're talking to two people who, even if you're on widely different sides, you're having that moment of communion and sharing in that. So I wanted to hear a little bit more about just how you felt reaching out to people in love, you know, is or isn't effective.
Cool. Yeah, all right, so I think we're on three. We'll see. Just be sure anybody would like you to talk.
No, she's there.
It's three. It's three.
That's three.
Okay, you're the first to the next question.
I was just going to say, Sarah's right, that that personal narrative is a very effective way to speak. It's hard to argue against a personal narrative. That's it. And yeah, amen, Ashley.
Just add briefly that I think everyone would probably agree here that it's not about either love or dissent. It's about both. And I studied the civil rights movement enough to know that Martin Luther King once said that power never voluntarily relinquishes itself. It has to be forced to do so. So yes, you need Malcolm, and yes, you need Martin, and you need both. And so I think that sometimes ex-Mormons and anti-Mormons are the church's greatest friends. But we also need those voices of love, and we need a balance.
I guess I could use that microphone. I'm smart. I really like what both Christine and, what was your name?
Ashley
said. I kind of sat there and I said yes, because I think they both have a point. And I think that there's sometimes a time in your life when you have to say, I don't agree with you, but I love you and I will go with you on this. And I think there's a time when you have to say, no, I'm putting my foot down and I'm not going to go any further. And I know that if Martin Luther had said, I love you, Catholic Church, and I'm going to go with you on this, even though I think you're wrong, a lot of things probably wouldn't have happened in Western civilization. But like I said,
probably Mormonism.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think you're both right. I think that there are times when either or is called for, and I wish that we had a key for determining when it's one and when it's the other, but I think that they're both valid approaches.
Yeah, if I can just back to the first thing one person asked about strategies, and Christine mentioned that obviously the internet seems to be a way to encourage dialogue. There's a new LDS feminist group called LDS Wave. Talk to Teresa Stark. And yes, let's do this. Let's build both the love and the resistance. And let's tell the stories like the story of Ashley's brother, because that there is, I mean, Elma says at one point there's the power, what is it called, the force of pure testimony. And there's something to that. And telling the testimony about the story of Ashley's brother is something that can't be denied.
I agree. Is this working?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to echo what Jane Ann said about it being difficult to leave the church because of what people say about people who leave. And I know it was really hard when I was leaving because of not just what people said, but in family cultures, like my dad's side of the family, about half of his family left, and I didn't want to be like what my dad said about my uncles, and he'd be like, well, you know Uncle Lynn, he's an apostate. And so I didn't want to be that example to my nieces and nephews. So I wanted to echo what she said, but also I found it really interesting because I voiced some of my concerns and to my bishop, and he said, well, go ahead and pray to Heavenly Mother. You know, that's all right. Just don't tell anybody about it. So, I think, you know, some people are more supportive about that sort of stuff, even if they're in positions of authority. So as long as you keep your mouth shut, it's okay.
Sure.
I this question's been answered in a variety of different ways, but the church leaders don't overtly respect the opinions of the members, and as a consequence, that creates a culture wherein members don't respect each other's opinions unless they echo or amplify the opinions of the leadership. And so it's often not just about the people who are in authority over us. And, you know, my question, if you have anything to add from the things that have already been said, is how best to kind of break through that shell to get people to, you know, widen their vision and stop seeing this thing as narrowly in terms of whether they echo or amplify what the leadership says.
Thank you.
I had a comment and a question. The comment was directed to the topic of how we remove that stigma from people who do leave. I think that one of the most frustrating phrases that I hear is about people can leave the church, but they can't leave it alone. I want to say, I have a number of friends who all they want to do is leave the church alone, so I don't know what you mean. And as far as how to remove that stigma, I've been thinking nonstop about a session that I went to yesterday entitled The Stories That We Tell, and one of the presenters talked about how when Christ came to the Americas in the Book of Mormon, he showed his scars. That was how he proved to the people who he was and what he had done for them. And I just have been thinking about them so much, preparing a talk for Sunday and deciding, I really want to show my scars. Like, I really want to unite with the people that are around me and show them. I think that it's very risky and it's very scary to get up and say, hey, I'm a person who has thought about leaving the church, BS. Like, I have done that, and I have been there, and I'm still in that. And I think that's very scary, but I think it can be very edifying and very uniting. And I think blogging is a great way to do that. It's a way that I'm personally addicted to, but it's also, but there's so many people who don't really know the phrase blogger and apple, or don't. And so I think doing that in family relationships and in church settings can be really wonderful. I've had a lot of good experiences from that. And then I had a question. I've been thinking lately kind of about people, to use the phrases that we've been talking about here, people who want to use their loyalty through voice when they dissent, but through excommunication are forced to exit. I have an example of an uncle who was excommunicated but has remained in the church, still continuing to attend, sing in the choir, things like this. And how, I guess my question would be, what circumstances lead someone to be forced to exit but want to remain loyal, and what are the consequences of that, from your guys' experience of maybe even through home stories, knowing people who have gone through that?
Last time you started on that end, this time you start on this end, if that works for people. So, I mean, we had some great comments. Again, I love the idea of forced exit, because, of course, it's something which Hirschman's book does not talk about, because he talks about, you know, nobody's forced to stop, drinking a favorite cola. But, in fact, this is a much more searing experience, and so I think this is something which would tend to amplify a voice, but it's a very different sort of voice, and the organization is saying, don't listen to those people's voice in a very specific way, force them to exit. How do we break through the shell, as David mentions? I break through in a very, perhaps passive-aggressive way. I track down excellent quotes from church leaders that counteract negative things about church culture, and then they say, no, you shouldn't do everything, no, we don't have to all believe the same politically. Look what, look at the Piccolo talk. And then, look, here's a quote from the Piccolo talk by, he just passed away. He just passed away, the general authority. Piccolo's orchestra.
Worthland, Joseph B. Worthland.
Joseph B. Worthland. Right, so you read them the quote from the Joseph B. Worthland talk, and you say it's okay to have differences of opinion. Look, Joseph B. Worthland said it's okay. It is probably a little passive aggressive, but it's my final form. And I'll just finally say, we've mentioned the Blogonacle a couple of times. Maybe not all of you are familiar. Take a look at feministmodernhousewives.org. All of us together into a word. Follow the leads from there, and join the conversations.
When I talk to the people who have left, who also share your hatred for that, they can leave the church, but they can't leave it alone. The most common response is, we'll leave the church alone when they leave us alone, when they stop disparaging us, when they stop, following us to wherever we go and trying to get us to come back, when they start making our mothers and our fathers and our siblings and our children hate us. That's when we'll leave the church alone. That's how they feel. I'm not saying that's how I feel necessarily. As far as changing members' deference to authority, I think it needs to happen. Well, I think it can happen within church bounds and on Sunday. I think that's a very painful, personally costly approach to try and disrupt Relief Society or Sunday school or priesthood by your statements. I think it's a noble one. I think sometimes it's effective. But in my experience, it's best to engage those people when the mindset is sort of let down and you're in their home or on the internet when they've got their iPod in their ear and they're riding their bicycle. Their defenses are down and they're much more open to listening to other points of view. So that's just one thing. I don't know that I fully understood your question. Was it what makes someone stop believing the church but want to stay anyway?
Not so much that. Somebody, if my uncle was excommunicated, it seems like a pretty clear sign from the church, we don't want you here, but he feels loyal to the church and he has been coming for 20 plus years anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess
like
I
Levina.
What would make that happen and how does it end up working out?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of probably answers to that. I think he probably loved his experience in the church. There's just basic, Skinnerian or Pavlovian conditioning. If you are conditioned to love the church for so long, neuroscience tells us that there's no such thing as unlearning something. You really can't disrupt those synapses once they're created. The best that you can do is create new learning on top of existing learning. And so that's why I call myself Mormon to the bone. I'll never stop being a Mormon, regardless of my activity, because nothing will ever touch me like Kunkumi Saints.
I actually just want to say that I think people who are excommunicated or otherwise hurt by the church and stay are probably the most profound example of the kind of witness I was talking about. I mean, to stand and sing in the choir, it means that nobody else in that congregation can ever say all apostates are bitter, evil people who are, deserve to be gone. They know him and they love him, and that one example is worth, you know, millions of blog posts, for sure.
I'd just like to say something about the unifying theme of the panel here, and that's political economy as applied to the dynamics of the church. And Hirschman's using a methodology where people are pursuing their self-interest and organizations are pursuing their self-interest. And we've definitely seemed to have agreed that de facto these sort of utilitarian analyses of behavior in the church are the status quo. That's how it works. John DeLitt was pretty explicit that the church leaders are just viewing their decisions in a utilitarian fashion. And this raises a pretty big concern for me, because the acts that we consider the most moral and the most sacred, the most ideal, are those that ignore those sort of utilitarian and self-interested analyses. And that provides a pretty huge conflict for me, because this is an organization in which I've invested a great deal of my ideals and my spiritual energy. And for us all to assume that that's the case is deeply disturbing, but I'm wondering what you all think.
I'm also interested in any insight that you have into structural considerations. The church has a well-defined hierarchy, and I think there's probably a difference between effects of exit and voice on a local level versus a general level, and I think it also affects how local actions can affect other locations, because it really only communicates up through and back down through a hierarchy. And so I'd like to get some input on how structural considerations play their part in this.
My name's Kate. Thanks so much for doing this panel. I was wondering if you've already had one example of passive aggressively giving general authority quotes to people, but I was wondering if each panelist could say something concrete that they do, or a strategy that they use when they absolutely, when their heart is bursting and they absolutely must speak out. What do you do?
Great question. I think to address the first question, I think actually Christine would be the dissenter here. She may dissent to me, characterizing her as the dissenter. But her argument seemed to be that it's not the utilitarian, and perhaps I've been too implicated in, you know, I think that the church has the idea it's better that one apostate should perish than that a word should dwindle in unbelief. And, you know, it's a very utilitarian calculus, and I've made an argument on utilitarian grounds saying that maybe this word is not going to dwindle in unbelief if we're just absorbing helpful commentary from voice here. So I'm arguing and accepting some of the utilitarian premises, but I think Christine really makes this wonderful, very ontological argument, very non-utilitarian argument, saying the person engages in an act of sacrifice, which is not ultimately in their self-interest, and that is the most effective way of form of voice, which is, I think, a wonderful potential alternate articulation. How is this influenced by our structure? Well, because only the word can perish, at least in theory. I think the blog vernacular and the internet in general are flattening the church's structure. They're connecting words, they're connecting people, and so as a result, it's harder to quarantine an apostate in a word here or a word there, and that it would be very interesting to see how the organization responds to that. And strategies, I just ask questions. There are non-threatening ways to say things, and you don't want to appear to input alma, and you don't want to interrupt anyone's rejoicing. If somebody is really happy in the church community, I don't want to be the person who's going, haha, Joseph Smith drank coffee. At the same time, you know, we can recognize the options. And I remember a couple of months ago, actually, someone got up and gave testimony about the importance of creationism and the importance of knowing that evolution was the doctrine of the devil. And so I sort of felt like, what do you do in that? Like, I sort of wanted to stand up, but I didn't want to say, like, you know, you sir are an idiot. What I said, and I think it worked, is I said, I'm grateful for diversity in our ward, and I'm grateful for the fact that we have an orchestra that is not all piccolism. I included the piccolo talk, and I said, I love the fact that you can come here and you can hear a variety of opinions and know that we're all here to sort of understand each other, to learn from each other, and to build a community. And I think that worked. So that was my possibly passive aggressive response as well.
Yeah.
Oh, shoot.